The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
We all know the importance of play for children. They explore the world through play. They gather information through play. They learn social interaction through play. But when you leave childhood, should you put all those childish things behind you and abandon play? No, you should not. That's according to the title of a book written by my next guest. It's called simply Why We Play. Psychotherapist and author Joanna Fortune. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, this is a great book. There's all sorts of things in it. And the first thing that caught me was on page 23, what if? The game of what if. Now, explain that to me.
So, what if is a wonderful game. Just, you can do it yourself while you're sitting on public transport or just at your desk, even listening to the radio now. You could simply go, well, what if? What if this radio was suddenly to interview me live in my kitchen or live at my desk? What would I say? What if, you know, the sea was green and the grass was blue? What if? And you can go through a series of what ifs.
What if humans barked and dogs talked?
Yes.
That's one of the ones, yeah.
And then the invitation is to think that through. Well, hang on, answer that. What if that was the case? How would the world sound? What would I be saying in my dog language? What if is an invitation to engage our imaginative side of our brains and just to begin to dip our toe into a bit of playfulness.
Now, how does that connect with your vagal nerves?
Yeah, so of course, in this book, you know, as you've just pointed out with What If, peppered throughout the book are invitations to play. So you've got very practical play activities. But also, just so we understand, as the title says, why we play, I do include some of the science of that. And we're talking about polyvagal theory. We're talking about play as a neural exercise. So one of the things I say quite a bit is that play is a state of mind and it's a way of being. Because part of the challenge, especially in Western society, of relegating play to the realm of childhood is we see it as a box of toys in the corner of a room or all over your room. It's not. We
now,
have
you're
to
not
integrate
talking
it.
About the seven aside on a Sunday morning, or are you?
Well, I am and I amn't, because this is the other thing that I think more of us are playing without realising that we are. Because I know when I say that word, for a lot of people, it triggers this image of a 1980s children's TV presenter, hyperactive and colourful and going, oh no, that's not for me. But actually, there are many types of play. There are play patterns and tendencies that we all have, and there are play personalities that we have. So I might tend towards, I know this about myself, more whimsical play, more kind of jump in the puddles when you see them, more dance around the kitchen with having a silent disco for myself. I know that's part of my play tendency. But we could also be oriented towards more intellectual play. You know, we saw the boom of something like Wordle, how popular it was. That's a form of play. It's intellectual play in the way crossword puzzles or jigsaws, things like that are. So we have lots of ways of understanding. First of all, get to know, what is my play tendency? What is my play personality? Am I happy with that? Or is there another type of play pattern I'd like to, you know, play with and get to know?
You talk about the benefits of micro moments of joy. What are micro moments of joy?
So micro moments of joy are all around us. They are those little brief moments where we go, ooh, I love that. You know, it could be, and I say this, you know, that first blast of the shower on your skin in the morning, you're really tired and sluggish. You don't want to get up. You keep wanting to turn the alarm off. But once you get in, you get this moment of, I'm alive, I'm awake. It could be that first sip of coffee in the morning. And we tend to sip it in a way that, oh, yes, burnt my mouth, lovely coffee, and move on really quickly.
But savour the moment.
Savour it. That's exactly. 30 to 60 seconds would do you, Pat, every morning. Just sit in that moment of, oh, I really do love that. When we can savour the glimmer.
This is terrible to say, but people who smoke cigarettes get that, don't they?
They do. But I think that you can get it in lots of ways. So I think you can get it from the most simple things that actually we take for granted. You know, when you get on your train, you know, carriage, and you actually get a seat and you're thrilled, or you get to the biscuit barrel in the office and your favourite biscuit is still there. You know, we have these
now,
moments.
You also talk about, you know, making eye contact with somebody and smiling. But in this woke era, you do that and you might be creepy.
Well,
what's he doing smiling at me? What's he looking at? Oh.
I think it's how we do it, though, isn't it? I think so much is about how we do things as much as why we do things. When we can look at somebody, make eye contact and acknowledge, we are not only acknowledging their presence, but we are getting acknowledged back in return. So we get a lovely serve and return connection. And that's what we're talking about here, is moments of meeting, which are true moments of connection.
Okay, now, there are nice things that happen, like you arrive just at the bus stop and you think you're late, And lo and behold, you haven't missed the bus. It's late and you get on. And
it's that moment of kind of fortuitous joy, isn't it? And I really think that that's something that this book is exploring, is the nature of joy in our lives. You know, actually, for any of us to enjoy life or enjoy other people, we have to have been enjoyed by somebody. Joy is a shared experience. So we can look for joy and seek joy, but it starts with a reflective piece about who enjoyed you in your life as a child, and how did you know? And who do you enjoy, and how are you sure they know? So looking at joy in that shared way of interaction.
Now, laughter is important. There used to be a thing in the Reader's Digest, I remember as a child, and we'd go to the section that was called Laughter is the Best Medicine. And there'd be little funny stories, fairly harmless.
Anecdotes and the like, yeah.
So that is important.
It absolutely is, because laughter is one of the most effective and cheap, as in freely available, ways to release residual tension that we are holding in our bodies. So when, and I'm not talking about a forced laugh, although I do believe that if you start with a fake laugh, you'll end up laughing at yourself, so it can become authentic. But we're talking about a good old authentic belly laugh.
But there's
laugh.
A game you describe in the book, as I recall from last night reading this book, that you lie on your down with a group of people, and then someone puts their head on your belly, for example, and then the next person puts their head on the second person's belly, and so it goes, as many people as you have, and then the first person laughs. I mean, a fake laugh, if you like, but starts to laugh.
And then it picks up.
What happens then?
So it's called the laughter puddle. And not the kind of puddle that you might laugh yourself into making a puddle, but being the laughter puddle. So like you're saying, everybody's head on someone's tummy. When the first person starts to laugh, their tummy vibrates and moves, shaking the next person's head. That'll trigger the same response in them and so forth. And you end up in this just laughter heap on the floor, just having all you need. Now, that is one of the activities you do need play partners for. So in the book, again, I've broken it down into lots of activities you can self-direct. And then there are many other activities that you need a play partner for. That's one you need play partners for. But it is such good fun. And anyone who's tried it, that's the one, Pat, that I get most positive feedback on. I tried that one and it actually
and
was
it
hilarious.
And it works. Now, in chapter two, you talk about changing the stories we live by. And you talk about the three different arcs, if you like, and one is the ascending part. We came from nothing and look at all we've built and achieved as a family. The descending arc, we had it all and lost it all. Look at us now as we struggle to get by. And then the oscillating, which is probably most people's experience.
It is most people, where as a family we've had highs and lows, but ultimately we've come through it as a family. And those are, generally speaking, the tone of your family narrative. You will have grown up with a wealth of stories of times when, and when I was a child, and I remember in my day, and all of those stories. But we're storied people. We live storied lives. And story is much more effective from a brain point of view, an embodied point of view, than just reporting facts in a linear fashion. Because in the story, we are engaging imagination. We are triggering the parts of the brain that get excited and ignited with associations. And that's moving something from implicit awareness into more conscious awareness by interweaving it with narrative. But the tone of the stories that we have all grown up with, they do influence how we live. So there is a part of the book, you're right, where I invite us to do a reflective piece on looking back to those family narratives, questioning with curiosity, deepening our understanding from a position of what we'd call engaging our reflective functioning, you know, fresh thinking and new perspective. Yes, I remember that happening, but as I recall it, I have new perspective on it now from my adult position. Mm. And taking charge of writing the next chapter for ourselves. Yeah. How do we want the story to go?
You also talk about interrogating your past, like knowing where you came from and who, like, how did your parents meet?
Yeah.
How did your grandparents meet?
Yeah.
Where did they come from? What did they do? You know, like, it's who do you think you are on
it
the telly,
really
they
is.
Do that all
it
the
time.
It
really is. And there's a whole piece of research around that by Duke and Favouche around the do you know test. And the research shows that people who know a lot about their families, good, bad and indifferent, all of that, tend to be more emotionally resilient, tend to do better engagement, be more confident, articulate, able to stand up, defend themselves, assert themselves. So it's not always about having sugar-coated happily ever after stories, but understanding our stories as part of us.
Now, we're not going to go into all the book. You talk about play in adulthood, and some of it is obviously sexual play for some people.
Yes.
The difficulty of making friends as you get older. And this one, the importance of doing absolutely nothing.
I think that is one of the biggest challenges we're facing as society, is our lack of opportunity to be bored, truly bored. You know, boredom, I think that word as a parent can send a shiver down parents' spines when children say, I'm bored. But actually, out of boredom comes desire. And in a constantly switched on world where we're always fueling and feeding ourselves with flows of information, taking an opportunity to let your mind wander in that daytime reverie of, you know, daydreaming out a window, it allows us to assimilate our information, our experiences, to make meaning of it, to make those connections, to go, oh, do you know what I'm going to do? Or, do you know, now that I think about it, I bet if I... So out of that state of boredom comes creativity, and out of creativity comes playfulness. So a bored mind is actually a route to a playful mind.
Well, the book is called Why We Play, How to Find Joy and Meaning in Everyday Life. It's published by Thread. Its author is Joanna Fortune. And before I let you go, Joanna, you were saying during the last commercial break that you had spent time in Russia working in orphanages.
I did.
How do you feel for some of the people that you met there? Because...
Oh, absolutely. I used to work with the Irish charity To Children With Love in orphanages in Russia for a number of years. And I do, the whole situation is heartbreaking. But, you know, we also look at, you know, when we're talking about deployment of soldiers, so many soldiers are just boys. They're just young men, you know, kids out in the world. And a lot of the young boys that I would have known through the orphanage system would have been drafted into the army.
No
parents to
mentor
them. Because they'd have no other options.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they're very vulnerable boys as well.
Being sent as cannon fodder to
the front line. And, you know, it's very hard not to have an empathic tug towards that side of it, though the whole situation of war is heartbreaking.
Joanna Fortune, thank you very much joining us in studio.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.